Well, this is class number 9 in our analysis of literature course, semester number 2. Today we continue to consider chapter 10 in the textbook, which is The Snows of Kilimanjaro by Ernest Hemingway. A written assignment for chapter 10 is due by next class. That is questions 1, 20, and 25 in the workbook. So we are going to now continue to go through those other questions that are found in the workbook. I should mention that before the next class, class number 10, make sure to have read chapter 11 in the student textbook, because that will be the topic of discussion in the next class. All right, then. Well, I believe we left off at question number 12. And so let me pose that question to you. It says, in literary criticism, stream of consciousness denotes a literary technique which seeks to describe an individual's point of view by giving the written equivalent of the character's thought processes. Stream of consciousness writing is strongly associated with the modernist movement. Stream of consciousness writing is usually regarded as a special form of interior monologue and is characterized by associative and at times dissociative leaps in syntax and punctuation that can make the prose difficult to follow, tracing as they do a character's fragmentary thoughts and sensory feelings. Stream of consciousness and interior monologue must be clearly distinguished from dramatic monologue, where the speaker is addressing an audience or third person and is used chiefly in poetry or drama. In stream of consciousness, the speaker's thought processes are more often depicted as overheard or addressed to oneself and is primarily a fictional device. Do you believe The Snows of Kilimanjaro is marked by use of stream of consciousness?
Yes.
Okay, yes it is. Can you give me examples in the short story where it is found?
The words in italics.
Okay, yes, the words in italics. So for instance, let's look at a specific example. For instance, went into the story, it says, now in his mind he saw a railway station at Karagach, and he was standing with his pack, and that was the headlight of the Simplon event, and so on and so forth. So what parts of this short story go into this sort of stream of consciousness method?
When he's thinking about past.
Right, when he's thinking about his past events. And why do you think it would be employed as a literary device in Hemingway's short story?
It was useful not only in telling his past, but also in his mind processes as he was realizing he's going to die and reminiscing about all that was past.
Right, so it's a way, as it were, to get into his interior, to see how he's thinking as he is in the process of passing away. All right, Kilimanjaro is a snow-covered mountain 19,710 feet high and is said to be the highest mountain in Africa. Its western summit is called the Masai, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Nagai, the House of God. The snows of Kilimanjaro seem to be a symbol in the short story. Of what is it a symbol, in your opinion? Of what is it a symbol? What do you Do you have any thoughts on what it would be a symbol of?
I guess where he was going when he died. Or...
Okay, in some sense it... So it symbolizes where he goes when he'll die. What does whiteness normally in literature symbolize?
Purity, it's a positive.
Right. Hope. It's normally, let's say, the opposite of perhaps red. It's pristine. And so, this is where he is, you know, headed. That which is perhaps pristine. It's interesting, you know, you wonder what did Ernest Hemingway really believe about eternity. I don't know, can one tell by this short story? Because obviously he's saying this is where he is headed. Of course, I'm just turning to that section. And he says he saw the square top of Kilimanjaro. So, any other thoughts on that? All right. Of course, there is a great deal of sadness because you wonder. Does it seem that Hemingway, or the character that in some sense is quasi-Hemingway, the main character in this story, Harry, does it seem he believes in the Bible in terms of what he thinks happens after death?
No.
No, so he doesn't have that, and it's not like, does he believe in the Islamic view or something, or some other... So there's a certain sense in which... there is not much comfort that Harry can take with him into death. What were the last thoughts of Harry before he died?
Well, he was just looking at Kilimanjaro, and he knew that's where he was headed.
Right. He was headed. He knew he was headed towards the top of Kilimanjaro. Now, were those thoughts of his even true?
No, it was more of a dream.
Okay, it was a dream. So, his last thoughts were of not of something that really was the case, right? What is the significance of that? Or do you think there is any significance to the fact that his last thoughts... Because an alternative, right, would be whether one is Christian or pagan or whatever, one can have true thoughts to a degree. He could just know he was dying.
Well, he was thinking he was being rescued.
Right. But, you know, there is, at least for me, a real sad... I don't know, irony in the fact that even his last thoughts were delusional. He what he thought was happening was not really happening. What do his last thoughts suggest about his perspective at the end of his life? Or do they suggest anything?
Well, that his life was a waste and delusional.
Right, right. That his life was a waste and delusional. Okay, the short story served as the basis of a movie. Here is how the movie has been described. As writer Harry Street, played by Gregory Peck, lays gravely wounded from an African hunting accident, he feverishly reflects on what he perceives as his failures at love and writing. Through his delirium, he recalls his one true love, Cynthia Green, played by Ava Gardner, who he lost by his obsession for roaming the world in search of stories for his novels. Though she is dead, Cynthia continues to haunt Street's thoughts. In spite of one successful novel after another, Street feels he has compromised his talent to ensure the success of his books, making him a failure in his eyes. His neglected wife, Helen, played by Susan Hayward, tends to his wound, listens to his ranting, endures his talk of lost loves, and tries to restore in him the will to fight his illness until help arrives. Her devotion to him makes him finally realize that he is not a failure. With his realization of a chance for love and happiness with Helen, he regains his will to live. What are the differences between the movie version, as described above, and the actual short story?
The movie had a good ending because then he regained his will to live.
Okay. So it had a different ending. Any other differences?
Well, the context of how he got there was different because with him, with this in the story, there were so many things he hadn't written. And it's not like he necessarily...
Right. So what you're saying is, in the short story, the main idea was that he hadn't written all these novels. But in this movie, according to this summary of the movie, he has written a lot of novels. So that's another difference. Any other differences?
I don't remember anything about, like, Cynthia Green or something.
Well, I do think it talked about, when he was reminiscing or in the stream of consciousness mode, it does talk about some of his past romantic life. Now, that specific person, okay, so that's another difference. Any other differences? It says here that in the movie that wife Helen endures his talk of lost loves. Did that happen in this short story?
No.
No. Why did it not happen?
He was just thinking it.
Okay, now my question is, why would they make all these changes? Do you have any thoughts on that? Because there are significant changes here, right?
It would probably be more appealing for a movie to have those changes.
Why do you think it would be more appealing? Is it a different audience?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying it would be more appealing to the audience that would watch the movie, more appealing than the audience that would read the short story? Why?
Well, the type of people who would read the short story are more like the intellectuals who don't mind reading something depressing, But the type of people who'd want to watch the movie probably would want a good ending.
Okay. At least back in the time when this movie was done, but probably even still today, right? People don't want to come out totally depressed. Okay, so that would be one reason they changed it. Any other reasons they changed it? Well, let me ask you this. How would you even go about doing this short story if you tried to do it in a movie? What happens when you try to dramatize something? Would it be possible to do this?
Well, you couldn't get
the thoughts you'd have to say for people to hear, obviously.
Right. So how would they even handle that, his thoughts? What are some alternatives?
Well, they could kind of show what was show what was happening in his earlier life somehow.
Right, okay. But then it's still sort of hard to see how that gets to is in his mind, right? That's not easy, at least. Another aspect is, we find it, let's say, some like in older literature, they handle this in terms of bringing it into drama, is the main character might do sort of soliloquies that the audience hears. That's the way it was done, but why do more modern drama try to stay away from that, do you think?
It can bore people, probably.
Yeah, I think that aspect, and they try to be more, that seems a little bit unreal. And they've tried to be more like, more the way one would, things happen in terms of real life, in terms of, so these are some reasons, but we see here the difficulty in taking something that's in writing and turning it into an accurate drama. It is very difficult. This is a great difficulty, as I've even mentioned before, as far as, okay, taking a history book and making a movie of it. Let's say we have a past history, a written history. It is very, very difficult to do an accurate drama of it. In fact, I would say it's really almost impossible. And so what typically happens, it's fictionalized. In the process of trying to dramatize it, it's actually fictionalized. And so we see the discrepancy between the short story and the drama. To the extent that this short story consists of different symbolisms and metaphors, do you have any thoughts about what Harry's gangrene is a metaphor for?
Well, in a way, it reflects his abandonment of writing for the easy lifestyle he got with Helen. Because he said that the gangrene was painless, but it just made him tired, and so he didn't feel like doing anything. Sort of the way his marriage to Helen made him stop writing.
Okay, so it's sort of the parallel between how Helen's influence on him in the short story got him away from writing, and so there's this parallel symbolism. Let me read for you what someone else has written on this subject. You just know things are going badly when the story opens with the image of vultures circling in the air and their protagonist apologizing for the odor of his rotting leg and then suggesting that his wife either amputate the limb or shoot him. Africa is a magnificent setting for this story. Natural beauty and danger lurk everywhere. Harry's death and dying is punctuated by self-examination and frequent recollections of his past. Harry, too, has squandered his time and talent. Only near death does he comprehend the truth about his life. He realizes that despite the trappings of comfort and success, he is a lonely man who is actually bored with everything, even his own death. The gangrene of his leg is a striking metaphor for his self-destruction and wasted potential as a writer, husband, and human being. Now he suffers more from his own chastisement than from the painless progression of the gangrene. Again, the idea of the painlessness that you were mentioning. Yet his fatal infection deepens his insight, and a moment of lucidity replaces all his regrets and failure. The snows of Kilimanjaro speaks to both altitude and attitude, how high we aim, the excuses we make, and what we ultimately settle for. Now that is, one person's perspective, a literary critic's perspective on it. Do you have any thoughts about that perspective? Because it was interesting, y'all's view of it, and I will say to a great extent mine, was that the story had a what ending?
Sad.
A sad ending. But what is this literary critic's view, sort of?
That there was sort of, not necessarily happiness, but sort of realization of reality. So in that sense, it was happy.
Why do you think this literary critic has a different perspective on it? Because he's almost portraying that as a happy ending. That this is how someone would die thinking about the snows of Kilimanjaro. Thinking he's going into it. Do you have any thoughts about why the literary critic would think one way, and obviously y'all thought another?
Well, at least he was happy when he was, like, in his last moments, I guess. And if you don't think there's anything after that.
Right. And so, in one sense, what you're saying is, you know, if the literary critic basically was maybe of Hemingway's view or something, that this is really the best that could be hoped for. Someone, I guess, dies in a delusion that he's going into the snow of Mount Kilimanjaro. In some sense. I think it does reflect on the perspective, and one sense that it's this is considered a happy ending is somewhat reflective of what mankind, in terms of if he has rejected divinely revealed truth, ends up settling for, and really in some sense has to settle for. The best thing that can be hoped for is a delusion. Or, you know, sort of ending out on a happy note, even if it's delusional. Some have read The Snows of Kilimanjaro as an autobiographical self-portrait of Hemingway himself. Do you agree? Why or why not?
I think so. He was also a writer. He also suffered from some, like, cynicism and...
Right. So he suffered from some cynicism. He was a writer. But are there some... There are some striking differences, right? Between the real Hemingway and this Harry, the protagonist. What are some of those striking differences?
Well, Hemingway had success as a writer.
Right. I mean, he definitely was a famous author. So why do you think he would. So there are at least this and probably more areas of divergence. But why this specific area of divergence? Why do you think that Hemingway would incorporate that rather striking divergence?
Maybe he wasn't as satisfied with his writing as he wanted to be.
Right. Maybe it reflects in some sense his lack of satisfaction with his writing. Also, perhaps it reflected his struggles, things that he felt he had to struggle with. Even when, and I'm sure all of us, there are many times when one strives for a goal, right? And one thinks, well, if I just get to that goal, I'll be happy. But then what typically with man happens once he's achieved his goal?
It's not as nice once you're there.
Right. That is not... And so you think that maybe Hemingway even experienced some of that? Maybe he had thought... I believe Hemingway committed suicide, didn't he? I think he committed suicide. That says something about... But I'm sure there was an earlier part of his life if he had thought, wow, I can become this very well-respected author and traveled so, you know, and led a somewhat, well, very, in a worldly sense, an interesting life that... That will bring me great happiness. And that is probably something that he had to struggle with when all that he had hoped for did not come to fruition. Even though, unlike Harry, he did become a famous author. Read as a self-portrait, what would the Snows of Kilimanjaro suggest about Hemingway?
That he wasn't the happiest of people.
Okay. This is what someone has said. This short story written in 1938 reflects several of Hemingway's personal concerns during the 1930s regarding his existence as a writer and his life in general. Hemingway remarked in Green Hills that politics, women, drink, money, and ambition damage American writers. His fear that his own acquaintances with rich people might harm his integrity as a writer becomes evident in this story. The text in italics also reveals Hemingway's fear of leaving his own work of life unfinished. All right. Next question, 19. Ernest Hemingway, as a result of his short stories, novels, and nonfiction, has become one of the best-known American writers of the 20th century. In such novels as The Sun Also Rises and A Farewell to Arms, Hemingway chronicled the lives of aimless, adventuring young adults in Europe in the early decades of the 20th century. In other writings, Hemingway wrote elegantly and perceptively about some of his passions, bullfighting, hunting, fishing, and drinking. How does The Snows of Kilimanjaro bear the typical imprint of Hemingway the author, in your opinion, based on this description of him and other things that you might have read about Hemingway? If you didn't know that this was written, I mean, in other words, let's say that this had whited out Hemingway as author, do you think you could have read it and said, you know, based on what you do know about Hemingway, that, yeah, this sort of fits in with the sort of thing that he would... Would you know that what century this was written in, do you think? Okay, I think so, too. We would probably know this was not like something from Shakespeare's time, right? There are various differences in styles. Even something different about it from, let's say, even the 19th century, right? What are some differences there?
Well, this book is more postmodernist, like, it's more cynical.
Right, right. More postmodernist in the sense of being cynical and so forth. Very much aspects of most more postmodern, and that associated with the 20th century and now the 21st century. Any other things that strike you as just, you know, come strike you as typically Hemingway to the extent that you understand Hemingway?
Well, it's about an adventurous person, and they're hunting.
Hunting, drinking, right. His adulterous sexual lifestyle, so forth. What is the tone of the short story at its outset and then at its conclusion?
Well, both the beginning and the end, it's... it dwells on, like, the... just, detail about his wounds and just the setting.
So how would you describe the tone? I'm asking about tone here. Would you say there's a certain sadness and desperation in the tone of both the beginning and ending? Right, as far as person with gangrene out there, stranded, and then at the end, how does it end? Not in terms of what we know, what his life was, but in terms of the end of the short story.
His wife just realized that he died.
Right, his wife has realized he died, her heart's beating, and so forth, the beating of her heart. Okay. What are some of the themes of the short story?
Regret.
Okay. Regret. Any other themes that you can think of?
Disillusionment.
Okay, disillusionment. Someone has said that one theme is death. What do you think the cry of the hyena symbolizes at the end of the story? Why do hyenas behave that way?
I guess to communicate with other hyenas.
When what?
When there's something to eat that
do you
is
know,
died.
There you go. What do hyenas do? Do you know when something is dead?
Well, they're scavengers.
Yeah, they're scavengers, so they come and, right, they then come and all gnaw on the dead corpse. Let me read something that someone has written. One theme in this a short story is death. As the story of an imminent death, the snows of Kilimanjaro is suffused not only with images of death, but also with a pervading sense of death's presence. The story begins with death, described as "it's painless," Harry says in the first line, referring to his oncoming demise, and ends with the ironic comparison of the woman's heart beating loudly and the stillness of Harry's lifeless body. Death is symbolically figured both as the pristine whiteness of the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro and as the creeping, filthy hyena that lurks outside of Harry's tent. So you have these two different aspects of death at the end, the symbolism of them, the cry of the hyena versus the pristine whiteness of Mount Kilimanjaro. What are the telltale signs in the short story that Hemingway as author and Hemingway as Harry has been fooled by the lie of Darwinian evolution, even though this is never explicitly said?
It seems like this is just all there is in life.
Yes. Sort of survival of the fittest. Do you see any aspects of that in the short story? And you know, well, someone dies and that's it. The total of the materialism that, and essentially the lack of reference to the supernatural in terms of the thinking of either Harry or Helen. Okay, the type of narration Ernest Hemingway typically uses, the author himself said in an interview with George Plimpton, was fashioned on the principle of the iceberg. For 7/8 of it is underwater for every part that shows. In A Movable Feast, his memoir of Paris in the 1920s, he expands on this. You could omit anything, he writes, if the omitted part would strengthen the story and make people feel something more than they understood. Do you think this is true in his short story, The Snows of Kilimanjaro? In other words, that certain things have been omitted, and maybe even purposefully by the author, in order to strengthen the story.
Yes, because they're probably like eating stuff like that that were left out.
Mm-hmm. And maybe even aspects of his life that we do we. I mean, we know parts of his past life, but do we know all of his past life, really? Like, do we really understand his childhood and so forth? No, there are large aspects of his life, even, that if this had been, let's say, a biography, or, I mean, if this had been, like, covering his whole life, we would know more, but there are large sections of his life, even, that we really don't know about. We just know bits and pieces here and there. What do you think is the effect of this, these omissions in the story?
Well, it puts the focus on the main points of the story.
Okay. Yes, it puts focus on what are his main points, and without getting into details that he did not think necessarily either mattered or he wanted to keep them rather vague in the story. All right, next question. Human fashions change unlike God's law. When Hemingway wrote his short story, sexism, that's quote in quotes, was more acceptable than it became in the 20th century. Hence, some late 20th century critics have been critical of the quote sexism in Hemingway's writings. Do you detect sexism as that term came to be considered at the end of the 20th century in The Snows of Kilimanjaro? How would you know that this was more written at the beginning of the, you know, let's say the first half of the 20th century than the very end of the 20th century? Do you think?
Well, the wife was just constantly trying to please him. And she didn't really, like, care about her own self, really. Even though he didn't treat her well.
Uh-huh. How are... So you can see, right? I mean, this is... Well, let me read what one thing that was written about this. Historically, critics have been divided on the merits of Hemingway's work. While contemporary critics praised Hemingway's mastery of form and narration, later critics took Hemingway to task for the limitations of his themes, for his perceived sexism, and for his extremely negative views of human life. Recent critical opinion has come to see Hemingway primarily as a stylist who has nothing profound or deeply original to say about the human condition. And although his influence on today's short story writers is difficult to overstate, many critics today believe that Hemingway, they look more negatively on Hemingway than let's say, maybe 20 or 50 years ago. So you have here, and something that we've even mentioned, you have even what is regarded as politically correct, let's say in 1900, even though it was based in humanism, is different from what humanism considers politically correct today. And so you do have this changing, humanism has changing standards. How is nature portrayed in the short story?
What's used to symbolize the Harry's various emotions? Like, on the one hand, the snows of Mount Kilimanjaro.
Okay, all right, so the different emotional states. How else is nature portrayed in it? It's something that I think alluded to earlier when we were discussing about the implicit evolutionist views.
It's sort of portrayed as being in competition.
Yeah, the whole aspect of nature being, in some sense, it's uncaring, unyielding, it's a survival of the fittest type of situation. And of course, if one does not believe that nature is is created by God, but rather that it's sort of like a dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest, what can that lead to in terms of one's perspective on life?
One can be more like just looking for oneself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What does Harry most regret about his past? Is this what he should most regret, scripturally speaking?
The fact that he wasn't able to write more.
Right. Is that what he should most regret, scripturally speaking?
Well, he should have regretted the different many sins he committed.
Right. All right. Someone has written, "The stench of painlessly rotting flesh slowly leading up to death, the physical rot and the anesthesia offered by drink is a metaphor for the corruption of the conscious spirit encroaching on the soul of the man." Do you agree or not with this view? The stench of painlessly rotting flesh slowly leading up to death, the physical rot and the anesthesia offered by drink is a metaphor for the corruption of the conscious spirit encroaching on the soul of the man.
I think so.
Why? Not sure, huh? This is one person's perspective, and it may well have been something that was intended by Hemingway that... that his conscious spirit, in some sense... you know, led to bad things. It's something to, it's a thought that's interesting to think about whether he did or not. Compare insights you can obtain into the life of the unregenerate in the short story, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, with insights on the life of the unregenerate in Ecclesiastes.
Well, vanity, I guess, of life.
Okay, so both of them show the vanity of life under the sun without God. Any other insights, or comparing the insights of Ecclesiastes versus this short story?
Both are the perspectives of someone late in life who's looking back.
Okay, someone late in life. Any other, how else would you compare it? Well, let me suggest, of course, Ecclesiastes does, it ends with what? Do you remember? Does it end in the way that this short story ends?
No.
Well, how does Ecclesiastes end?
With like, sort of like a solution or...
Right. What is that solution?
To remember thy Creator in the days of thy youth.
Okay, remember the Creator in the days of thy youth. So it's advice for the young. What else? You remember? It says that the sum of it is that we should fear God. And now, in terms of that positive message, does the short story of Snows of Kilimanjaro get that across?
No.
Okay, and finally, would you characterize Harry the character and Hemingway the author as an unregenerate realist or as an unregenerate idealist or both, and why?
Probably more realist.
Why realist?
Because his life wasn't, you know, just all happy and successes.
So in that sense, it was realistic. Is there any sense in which it was idealistic and not realistic? Even in terms of the end?
Well, depending on your interpretation of the snows of Mount Kilimanjaro and what the mountain symbolized, the kind of hope at the end was in a way unreal.
Right, right. The hope at the end, to the extent that that was hope, but even in any sense, is the snow representative of where Harry would have been heading if this is how Harry had lived and ended his life? Why is the snow not realistic?
Because, well, he ended up, he was just on the cot.
Okay, I'm talking about in his thoughts, ending up in the snow, let's say. He was headed towards the snow. Why is that not realistic? What is the reality of where he was headed?
Well, he was, of course, Harry didn't exist, but he was going to hell.
Right, right. And he did not realize he was evidently going to hell. And to the certain extent, what is very different in terms of even the symbolisms of snow versus hell, right? And do you think that's an accident? What in the scripture, what is hell symbolized as? What?
Fire.
Fire. And is snow the opposite of fire, and how?
Well, it's cold and it's wet.
Right, cold and wet versus hell being symbolized typically as hot and a very uncomfortable and dry, maybe. So we have these two aspects. In the one sense, yes, Harry was realistic in that life under the sun without God is miserable in many respects, so in that sense it's realistic. But he's idealistic in thinking that the end is simply snow. The end is actually much worse if one has lived life just under the sun without the fear of God. Okay, are there any more thoughts on this particular short story before we close? That's all the questions that I have. Any other thoughts? All right, then.
We discussed it. Why did he die from gangrene versus why did Ernest Hemingway use gangrene instead of, let's say, hemorrhage? You know, he dying from bleeding or something. Did you discuss it?
No.
Why gangrene? Why did he use gangrene? Why not an accident?
Well, it's very gradual, so then it could kind of... It would work better with the story.
Uh-huh. What else?
Painless, isn't it?
It's painless. It is painless. And then what else?
It grows and just grows on you. So it's not like...
It grows on you?
You can't just... The way... You can't even prevent it so easily, can you?
Why don't you hear of people dying of gangrene today?
If you have the right medicines, you can stop it.
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely, it is definitely preventable, and he even knew it. He said, just amputate it, because if you don't amputate it, what happens?
It just keeps growing.
It spreads, and what else? He mentioned it in the story. What does the disease gangrene, what is the clinical picture of it?
Well, rot. It smells.
It smells, and you can see the actual rotting of the flesh. So it's really the presence of death, because you can see it right there. It's dying. Your tissue is dying.
So it's a much more, what should I say, poignant symbolism for death and the dying process, the gradual rotting of it. Again, the overall, and that, in the sense of, that's the element of realism of Hemingway, but the unrealism, the idealism, is not confronting the real necessity of fearing God. All right, then. Well, I think then we'll close today's discussion of the short story.